Once again, thank you for having me. I struggled with the name of this talk. I was kind of thinking about what is the purpose of this presentation? How do we make it brief but informative? How do we connect with our community and our patients when they come to the emergency department? So I sort of thought about what it's like to traverse through the ER, what it's like to journey from the initial presentation all the way to discharge or potential admission, and what are things that we would like our patients to know, but also be aware of how we sort of think as ED practitioners. So it's customary in medical presentations to talk about conflicts of interest. I don't have any financial conflict of interest, but I do have a bias because I'm passionate about emergency medicine. And I do think emergency medicine is a team sport, more so than other specialties, in both working together with our allied health and nurses, but also working with our patients. I've worked in other emergency departments and clinics in several different provinces, and then in Toronto, as well as in very small locations up in Northern Ontario and rather large locations up in Southern Ontario and in GTA. I am biased because I find that our community has been the most supportive and the most exceptional community that I've ever worked in. And that's what makes me drive in for my shift day after day. What is the goals of this presentation? This talk, in the way that I've sort of pictured it, is not a detailed, specific presentation, but rather a conversation about what it's like to go through the emergency department, but from the eyes of the provider. How do we think, how do we consider people when they present to the emergency department, and how do we try to traverse that journey and help you through that journey? We'll talk a little bit about numbers and statistics, but those are just examples. Those are not specifics. The reality is varied and those numbers change. And I don't want to focus on the numbers. I also want to point out that this is simply how we do things at NHHER. That's not representative of other hospitals. Other departments I've worked in have other constraints and other resources. So this is how we try to sort of think and do things. I want to give you a glimpse into what we have as our resources and also a glimpse into our constraints. What are our challenges on the receiving end when somebody comes into the emergency department? I want to spend some time talking about the concept of triage. What that means for you as a patient, what that means for us as a department, what information we see now with a new Epic system, what information do we not see, what is, you know, the process of an assessment and discharge, and how can you help in your journey, and how can we work together towards doing the safest and the most efficient job understanding your presentation and treating you. I think about emergency department as an example of what an emergency medicine is in a nutshell. And emergency medicine is an acute aspect or acute branch of medicine. And it doesn't mean it doesn't have to be something that's not chronic. It could be a new system. It could be an exacerbation of an existing condition or a chronic condition, but it is unpredictable and it's quite varied. And diagnosis and treatment are the mainstays of what we do as physicians and nurses that work in the ED, diagnosis being probably the first key. Because we can't treat you unless we know what exactly what we're treating. And in my opinion, communication is a huge aspect of that. And sometimes that gets missed because we're so focused on seeing everybody across the day. We always need to remember that each patient in front of us is an individual, and explaining to them what exactly why you think something's going on and why you don't think something's going on and it is important. You know, my staff laugh at me because they call it Paul spiels. You know, every time somebody presents with a particular cardiac condition, I explain the same thing over and over and over again. But it's important to explain your thought process to patients and communicate what the next steps are. And I think that's a key aspect. And sometimes it's more important even than diagnosis, because sometimes we don't have a diagnosis, but we want to explain why we don't think something's going on. And then the other important aspect of emergency medicine is that preparedness and constant preparedness is a necessity. And we'll talk about that in the concept of triage, but especially at NHH, when we're on the highway, we can get unexpected presentations coming in all the time. And we always have to be considering the what-if scenario. And sometimes that's hard to see as a patient, that we're also considering not only what's in our waiting room, but what could come in at any point, such as trauma, cardiac arrest, resuscitations. What are our goals in the ED? Our goals are to get you treated to figure out what's going on with you and to treat you and sometimes admit you and sometimes discharge you. My personal view on what is a goal of an emergency physician and as the ED chief, as us, as the department, divided into two categories. I've been a patient of the emergency department myself several times, so has my family. And so I always think about two aspects of our goals. We are here for you as the patient, but we're also here for those you love. In case they present to the emergency department. And for you, we are a partner in your journey. You know, we'll do our best to understand your concerns, do our investigations, understand your symptoms and look for acute reasons or acute findings. We'll try the best to get a diagnosis. Sometimes the hardest part in the emergency department is I can't give you a diagnosis. I can tell you what it's not, but my tests are designed to look for big, scary things and acute presentations. And so sometimes we'll say, listen, I don't know exactly what it is, but we've ruled out these particular things. If we found a treatment or we found a diagnosis, our job was to treat you or present you with treatment options and have a conversations. Sometimes that treatment takes time, and sometimes we can't take away all your symptoms. So when somebody comes in with a certain types of back pain, what medications you start people on take time to work. And that is something that we need to discuss with our patients and say, you know, we can manage your pain, but it won't be zero. And it will take time for the pain to get better, for the medications to work. Everything we do in medicine has risks and benefits, anything from admission to Tylenol. And same thing goes for pain medicine. And the same thing goes for certain antibiotics. We have to consider what the benefits and the risks are and have that discussion. And we want to get you home. We do want to progress you through your journey through the emergency department. And if we have not found anything acute, we want to get you home to your family and to your bed. We are not interested in keeping people in the emergency department if we don't have to. But sometimes our constraints force us to be a little bit delayed. But we're also there for those you love. The what if scenario, as morbid and as challenging it is to think about that, we're there for somebody that might present to the emergency department in an acute distress, perhaps in an acute cardiac setting, perhaps they're having a heart attack or a stroke. And we need to be able to attend to them and prioritize them and see them before somebody else. We want to identify the sickest patients, attend to them urgently. In order to do that, we need to always maintain a flow of patients, and we need to always try to keep some space open, and we always need to have a critical space open for things that might come in unexpectedly, that might require acute resuscitation, intubation, traumas, stuff like that. So we're there for you, but we're also there for those you love. And I think about this, and I was a patient in an emergency department many years ago, and I was waiting to be seen. And I thought, you know, if my parents came into this and they had something worse than what I had, I'd want them to be seen first. What are resources in NHHED? And again, this is more of a bird's eye overview, not a lot of specifics, but we right now have about 90 to 110 visits per day. That is about 10 to 15% above our averages pre-pandemic. That is also in keeping with our provincial numbers and across our LIN, we're up to about 10 to 15% on average emergency visits. The time until discharge might take up to 4 hours, 6 hours. Part of that is investigations take time. Part of that, we need space to see people. We have, in the perfect scenario, 25 to 27 beds. And the reason that I give you a range is we're always trying to improve our space. And we're always trying to find ways of how do we optimize our space and how do we see more people in the same constraints. We have 3 to 4 doctors every 24 hours. We have 2 sets of nursing teams. And we have lots of allied supports, which I'll highlight for you in this presentation. What are our challenges? Well, there's 25 to 27 beds, but they're not empty all the time. Some people are waiting for tests. Some people are waiting to see a specialist. Some people are admitted and they have not moved up yet. Some people are waiting to be discharged. So if you think about 24 hours and there's 25 beds and you're seeing about a patient every 6 hours, the math doesn't add up. The physicians and nurses work shifts and some patients take longer. Somebody who may have rolled an ankle and needs an x-ray to rule out a fracture might take us 5 to 10 minutes to see. If they need a cast, that might take 20 minutes to see, but some people might take 6, 7, 8 hours to see because they have repeat tests or they have certain investigations need to be done. And the allied health we talk about aren't available 24/7. Some of them work in different areas of the hospital. They attend the ED as well as the inpatients. Sometimes there could be unexpected scenarios such as equipment malfunction, CT scanner breakdown, your computer's not working. So those are all factors that play into what we are constrained by And because we don't live in a perfect world where we always start with an empty department with 25 empty beds. But how do we work around these? Well, first of all, we triage, which will be a big portion of this presentation. And secondly, work as a team. And that is something that I want to highlight through this. When somebody walks into the emergency department and sees the triage nurse, they are now part of the treatment team. And that is how we do things at NHH. In other hospitals where they have more doctors, they might have a different flow. But in our flow, every time I'm on as a doctor, especially for the morning or the evening, I know exactly what's going on in the department alongside with the charge nurse and alongside with the triage nurse. I know how many beds are taking, how many beds are empty. I know about patients that are coming in with specific types of symptoms. I know about any concerns or sort of unusual presentations. And we talk all the time. Even though to you as a visitor, it may not seem like that because you just see the triage nurse, but the triage nurse and the charge nurse are able to communicate with the physician at any point. And we discuss cases that are presenting. And we have something called medical directives, which are basically standing orders that allow nurses to do certain investigations before you physically see a physician. And they can discuss the case with us at any point. We utilize the waiting room. After some tests are done, we might send you back to the waiting room while we're waiting for them, because investigations take time. And we utilize our support staff. So triage is a key aspect of our practice. And remember, we talked about what emergency medicine is, and one of the two points of it is it's unexpected and it's varied. Triage is a system that allows you to allocate a resource that's not infinite. Our bed space, our time, our staff is not infinite. So we triage our day based on several key aspects. We triage presentations. So we triage patients that come in with stroke-like symptoms, chest pains, episodes of losing consciousness, head injuries, rolled ankles, and we dedicate a triage system to what the concern is and how acute the presentation is. We triage our investigations. Somebody that might have an appendicitis that's about to burst and needs to be seen sooner might need to have imaging first. Then somebody's got appendicitis that has got some time. We triage our space because if somebody comes in that's in a critical condition, you need to have the correct room for managing that patient. You need to have the correct staff. You need to have the correct nurse with the correct clinical experience in order to be able to manage that patient. So we triage the space as well. And it does mean that sometimes it makes you wait longer, but it also means that we're able to attend to sickest patients first. And it does mean that we're always ready for the unexpected. And no matter how busy the day is, in the back of our mind, we always know, what would we do if a car accident was to come in right now? Or what would we do if a heart attack or a stroke would come in right now? What have we done to improve? Over the past couple of years, we started pre-pandemic, and of course, the pandemic has changed some of our focuses, but we have constantly looked at our flow. We've changed our flow around the department over the past 12 months. We've changed the way we do investigations. We've changed the way we dedicate space to certain investigations in the ER. We've reopened Blue Zone a few years ago that is staffed by a nurse practitioner and a nurse that sees less acute concerns and works together with our physicians. We're constantly reassess our space. We constantly reassess our flow. We have meetings on a regular basis between the ED manager and myself and the main nurses, as well as with the rest of the hospital, and look through how can we improve the flow of our patients? How can we get to our patients faster? How can we minimize those delays that are manageable? And we're always hiring new support staff in Allied Health. So these are the people you might meet during your visit that are not the nurse and the physician that saw you. After you get triaged, you might see a registration clerk. Registration clerk is a person that takes your health card and pulls your previous chart and links your visit to the current chart. And that's very important because when we talk about things that we can see in our emergency department, that would be your previous notes, admissions, discharges, investigations, images. And unless we have the correct chart, we're not able to link you as a person to that chart. You might see lab technologists that do blood draws and ECGs. So currently we have a dedicated space for our lab technologists to expedite how quickly we do blood work for things like chest pains or abdominal pains, how quickly we do a heart tracing to make sure there's no underlying big heart attack. You might need the radiation technologists, and those are the folks that do your x-rays and your CAT scans, ultrasound technologists that can come in and do certain ultrasounds on our patients in the emergency department. You might need a pharmacy technician, and a pharmacy technician is somebody that will come and talk to you about your medication. They will take a look at your list if you have one, and they will also call your pharmacy and verify those medications and those doses and enter those in our new system so that we're able to know exactly what you take and when. You might need a crisis social worker, and those are folks that support our patients and their families through mental health crises, acute presentations, and other supports that connect our patients to the community resources in our community and mental health supports. You might need a respiratory therapist. Respiratory therapists are a branch of the hospital that manages respiratory presentations. They help us with puffers, they help us with education, but they're also specialized folks that are able to manage complex respiratory machines, ventilators, BiPAP, CPAP machines, and they work in the whole hospital as well as attend to us in the ED. You might meet our unit clerks, and they provide administrative support, phone support, and sometimes help us organize transfer. You might meet a geriatric emergency nurse. We have called a GEM nurse, and that is a nurse dedicated to the ED, who is there to try to support our elderly patients and connect them to resources in the community. You might meet a nurse practitioner who runs the blue zone and sees patients in blue zone together with our physicians. You might meet some trainees, nursing students, medical students, resident doctors, who will attend to your care and discuss your care with the rest of the team. And there's lots and lots more. And the reason that I wanted to highlight these is that is how we work around those constraints. That is how we take away this concept of you come in, see a triage nurse, see a doctor, and then get investigations done and get discharged. We all work together in this one big blob, in this one big team, and you will see these people during your journey, and I wanted to highlight their roles. And we talk about constantly improving. We actually just started hiring PSWs and porters, and those are folks that will be able to support the team and support the flow, transport patients, and that is an example of us always trying to find ways of how can we improve our flow and improve your care in a constraint where we can't just bring new nurses and new doctors immediately on board, right? So this is simply a sample of an ER journey, and part of this presentation is using an actual example. I wanted to highlight a couple of these slides to explain to you that we think through your journey in sections, and that journey and those sections are reflective of what you would go through as a patient. So the first part of that is arrival. When somebody walks into our department, they see a screener that asks you about any infectious symptoms. If you do have infectious symptoms, that doesn't mean you won't get seen. It just means you might be given a mask, and the triage nurse might be alerted that you have infectious symptoms. If you arrive in an ambulance, the screening is often done by the triage nurse as well as the medics themselves. In either case, the first point of contact for you in the emergency department is the triage nurse. And an important part of this is that your mode of transportation doesn't actually affect our assessment. It doesn't affect your wait times. It doesn't affect where you get placed in the emergency department. Somebody that might arrive in an ambulance might get moved into a chair, might get moved to a waiting room. Somebody that might walk in but is deemed to be quite unwell or sicker might get moved into a room immediately because of that triage process that we talked about. We assess everybody equally, no matter how they present to our emergency department, ambulance, walk-in, wheeled-in, wheelchaired-in, and we attend to our patients equally at the same time, and we assess them based on presentation. The initial assessment is done by a triage nurse. A triage nurse is a nurse with years of ER experience and clinical experience. They work together with the charge nurse and the physician teams, and they try to get a brief understanding of what brings you in and a brief understanding of your background. But they work together in the team, like I talked about a few slides ago. And if they have any concerns, they will speak to the physician urgently at some point. They will coordinate with the physician and the charge nurse. If somebody is presenting with chest pain, then they will order some investigations before a doctor talks to them. They will make sure that there's a heart tracing done to make sure there's no heart attack, and the physician sees the heart tracing urgently within 10-15 minutes. sometimes sooner. If somebody is in pain or if somebody is nauseous or vomiting, they can coordinate with the physician to ask for a medication to treat that symptom before they get formally assessed by a physician. If somebody needs a room because they're unstable and they're coming in an acute distress, they will coordinate with a charge nurse to take up some of those rooms that we're always triaging and moving forward and moving through so that we can get the right resource to the right patient. After the triage nurse, then a patient goes to registry, and registration clerks are the folks that will take your health card and pull up your chart that we talked about before. The point of this slide is that investigations are complex, and this is not meant to be a true flowchart. In fact, this is meant to show that there is no direct flowchart for us at NHH. After you register, you might see a doctor first who might order some tests. You might actually get tests done first before a physician sees you. You might get those tests done and a physician will see those tests before they actually speak with you. And that's important because that allows us to get to things like subtle presentation, unusual heart attacks, atypical symptoms, certain fractures faster. And then you might get moved to a waiting room, or you may not. You might get moved to a room and see another nurse. And the physician and the nurses are in multiple areas of this flowchart. And that is the point of the slide, is try to show you that there isn't an easy way how to progress somebody through the ED, but we think about it in these stages and we think about how do we address every single person as a team. And the doctor and the primary nurse are in multiple areas of this flowchart. And then after somebody's discharged, and we'll focus mainly on discharge and not admission here, then a physician will talk to you about what kind of follow-up is requested. Maybe there is a family doctor follow-up, or maybe there's a specialist follow-up, perhaps there's a follow-up in a different hospital, perhaps there's an allied health follow-up, and then when and how to return to the emergency department. So to talk through some more concrete examples, I want to walk you folks what would happen when somebody comes in with chest pain. I think that is an easy scenario to think about. I'm sure lots of us have had experiences with it, either ourselves or our family members. And that is also probably one of the most common questions I get from patients when they call, especially it was quite challenging during the pandemic with the visitation restrictions. And then patients would call and say, you know, my mom came up with chest pain. What has been done? So when somebody comes in with chest pain, they see the triage nurse, just like a flow chart. The triage nurse will take a history. And for chest pain specifically, we have this concept of medical directives. The medical directives allow the triage nurse to order blood work and a heart tracing before the physician talks to the patient. That blood work at ECG, potentially an x-ray, gets done immediately. And if there's any questions or concerns about how somebody's presenting, the triage nurse will talk directly to a physician. After that, the patient will be asked to move on next door to the registration desk, as you can see on the picture there. And the lovely folks at registration will take your health card and pull up your chart and link your visit to the chart. After that, you'll likely be asked to move to lab chair. And that is one of the things that we've done in the past 12 months to improve the flow through the department. So there are four chairs dedicated to doing blood work. And when you sit there, a lab technician will come and grab you and move you to a different room where they will do a phlebotomy or a blood draw, and they'll do a heart trace. The heart tracing gets immediately handed to the triage nurse, who, as you remember, has years of emergency medicine experience as well as clinical experience, who will then bring that to the physician. And the physician will assess the ECG promptly to make sure that there's no underlying arrhythmias, life-threatening arrhythmias, or heart attacks. And then they will lock that ECG in the chart. And they will review the ECG with the patient when they see them. But the actual ECG gets seen very, very quickly. After that, you'll likely be asked to move back to the waiting room. And then while in your waiting room, we're continuously monitoring you. The triage nurse is able to assess everybody in the waiting room. And the triage nurse is also responsible for doing some repeat vital signs. And again, if there's any concerns, the triage nurse works together with the doctor on as well as the charge. After that, you might be moved to a different room and that be attended by a different nurse, what we call a primary nurse. The primary nurse will take another history from scratch and ask you what brings you in and what kind of chest pain you're having. And once again, if there's any concerns about your presentation, something that's new, something that is a piece of history that wasn't given before, any concerns about your heart or your heart tracing, the primary nurse will communicate to the MD directly. You might get asked to go to an x-ray or walk to an x-ray department and get a chest x-ray, which is used oftentimes for chest pains. You also might meet one of our pharmacy technicians, and they will ask you about your medications, and they will take a look at your list if you brought one, and then call your pharmacy, ask for a fax from your pharmacy, and verify those medications, and then put that list into your chart. And then you finally see the physician. And the point of that I'm trying to make here is the physician assessment in this example case is all the way down the line. But if I'm working that day, I'm aware of every single chest pain, especially concerning chest pains, that comes into a triage within the first 5 minutes when they present. And even though you don't get to speak to the doctor right away, we're aware of all the investigations that have been done up to this point. And we'll take another history and we'll ask you again, what brings you in? And sometimes I get these questions from patients and they say, well, I've already said that a few times. Why do you keep asking me the same question? And the reason for that is that, remember that diagnosis is a key aspect of emergency medicine. And history is a huge part of that. In fact, you could argue sometimes more important part because subtle presentations, insidious presentations can present unusually. We're all different as humans. We're not cookie cutter. So asking you over and over and over again the same questions allows us to double check and understand exactly what brings you in. We talk about how people don't experience heart attacks the same way. Some people don't experience chest pain. Some people feel the elephant sitting in their chest, and some people just feel a little short of breath. There's other things we do in the emergency department that we repeat multiple times for your safety. For example, we continuously ask you for your date of birth and your name to make sure there's no medication error or lab error. We check your label on your wristband. We take your history multiple times, and we always ask your medications multiple times. The purpose of that is to make sure that we haven't missed anything. What we can see when you come into the emergency department is we can see everything that's been done at NHH previously. For example, we can see your previous imaging, we can see your previous admissions, your discharge notes, and your notes that were done at the hospital. With the new Epic CIS, it is quite nice that we're also able to see all of those things that have been done within all the hospitals within Central East. That includes Scarborough, Lake Ridge, Halliburton, Campbell Ford, Ross Memorial, and Peterborough. So if you see a specialist, or if you've had investigations or imaging done in one of those places, we should be able to pull those up quite easily now, which is the benefit of the new Epic system. We can use something called Connecting Ontario. Connecting Ontario is an old system that's been around for a long time, and it's got its positives and negatives, but what that allows us to do is see certain hospitals, such as some of GTA hospitals and Kingston, importantly for us, that participates in Connecting Ontario. So we're able to pull up that some of those notes and some of the notes from specialists that you've seen and some of the images. And that's why the registration clerk is so important. So for example, your Connecting Ontario is linked to your health card. So when we have the correct health card number, we're able to pull up the Connecting Ontario notes. What we don't see is your medication list. We don't see what your family physician sees when they are open up your chart within their own computer system. So we don't see your past medical history as your family physician would. We don't know your previous surgeries. We don't know your previous colonoscopies, gastroscopies, imaging, your family history. If you're over 65 or if you're using OTB, we're able to pull up your medication list through Connecting Ontario after hours. But if you're under 65, then we are not able to access your medication list unless we talk to your pharmacy directly. So how can you help? Help us get better history. If you can bring the medication list, the little sheet the pharmacy can provide, that is exceptionally helpful for us. In fact, we can all often glean your medical history from the medications you take. If you take medications that are unique, so rare medications, if you take rheumatologic medications, certain anti-rejection medications or cancer drugs, bring those with you. In fact, bring any medication you take with you. If you have a blister pack, take that with you, because that allows us to understand your history better. If you've had specific history, such as if you had specific cancer history, if you received chemotherapy, radiation, immunotherapy, if you've had certain heart conditions, if you had heart surgeries, open heart bypass, stents, pacemakers, please highlight those stories. And we will ask you about that. But it's important that unless we have notes about these procedures being done, we don't have direct access to them. Ideally, if they've been done within our hospitals, we can easily pull them up on new system now and see your notes and even see your cardiologist's notes. But not every specialist is part of the hospital. So oftentimes the way our system works, and this is not NHH, this is more of a global comment, is sometimes specialists who work in the hospital, their clinic is not part of the hospital proper. So their notes may not link in to that hospital system. If you've had certain surgeries, so cancer surgeries, appendix surgeries, gallbladder, aneurysms, please highlight those for us. It is very helpful for us to know, even if they're not related to why you're presenting. And if you speak to your family physician and the family physician advises you to go to the ED, it is very helpful if they can fax us a copy of something called a CPP or a cumulative patient profile. That is what the family physician sees when they see you in the clinic. So they have your past history, your medications, all the things that we're talking about here. So if they're able to fax that to us or hand you a copy if you're in their clinic physically, that is very helpful for us. So we'll go back to the physician assessment. So we'll take another history. We might order more tests. Certain card presentations require a repeat test in 2 to 3 hours. And that is where that length of stay time that we talk about, we say up to 4 to 6 and sometimes longer hours, is because sometimes your first test is indeterminate. And if we want to make sure that we've ruled out any subtle heart condition or subtle heart attack, we need to repeat the heart tests, and those are time linked. So oftentimes at this point, repeat heart tests are done 3 hours after the first blood draw. So that lengthens your stay. Also, sometimes certain chest pain is really abdominal pain that's reversed. Maybe you need imaging or investigations for abdominal pain. And that's because, again, as humans, we experience symptoms differently. We will talk about what we have when we haven't down, we haven't found, sorry. And sometimes the family, the physician, the emergency physician will come back and reassess you after those repeat tests are done. We'll review what blood work we've done, what we found or have not found. We will talk about discharge or admission. We will talk about follow-up. And everything that we write within the Epic system now gets automatically faxed to your family doctor. And that is a great improvement compared to our previous system. So the moment that I sign your chart, when you're discharged from the emergency department, a copy of my note gets sent to your family physician. When you talk about follow-up, we will oftentimes talk about what we ask you to do. So for example, if we ask you to follow up with your family doctor, so my note might say, you know, patient advice to follow up with their family doctor within 2 to 4 weeks. But your family doctor might take time to receive that note. So we ask that you call to make an appointment if we've advised you to. You might be referred to a local specialist or a specialist in a different hospital. For example, would be in the internal medicine clinic or a fracture clinic in Peterborough. And typically in those cases, the clinic will contact you directly for an appointment. But this may vary, and we'll highlight that for you before you leave the ED in terms of what should you do next. We often ask you that if you already have a relationship established with a certain specialist, that you call yourself to make a follow-up appointment, because if you have a cardiologist and you presented with chest pain and we've ruled out scary things in the emergency department, there's no reason to refer to a different cardiologist. You might as well follow up with somebody who knows your heart, knows your history, knows you better. And it sometimes is faster for yourself to call them and ask for a follow-up appointment. And we could forward our note. But again, sometimes that's not perfect. The family physician note is automatic. The specialist notes have to be forwarded. And I always sort of think about plan A, I fax the note, but plan B, I ask you to call as well. Some of the supporting hospitals that we work with for follow-up are places like Peterborough Regional. That's where our pediatric clinic is, fracture clinic is. That's where the cardiac lab is for stents. And that's also our stroke center. Kingston General houses neurosurgery that attends to our patients. Oshawa and Lake Ridge houses the plastics clinic. And then if somebody presents with a trauma or certain conditions, they might be referred to a hospital at GTA. What can you do to help us with our communication? Well, first of all, verify that we have the correct family doctor on file. That could be done at several steps. When you speak to the registration clerk, Brian Petriage nurse, just make sure they have the right family doctor on file. Same thing at disposition and discharge. You can ask the nurse to verify or the doctor to verify that you've got the right family doctor on file, because what I want is my note to go to the right person. When we talk about communication with our families and our patients, we try to update the families as much as we can. but it would be very helpful for us for every family to have one person that is the point of contact. So if they want to speak to the treating team, they want to speak to the primary nurse or the physician, they can speak with us directly. Let's say they're not at the bedside and calling in, but we ask that that is the one person that is then the point of communication with your family so that we can explain things thoroughly once, and then you can talk to your rest of your family about what's been done. That is a little bit easier now that the visitation rules are open. That was a big consideration for us during the pandemic and the lockdowns. And then if your family member has a phone on them, then you can speak with them directly. You don't have to call the emergency department, you can just call them directly. But if they don't have a phone, or if their battery is not working, then we have phones that our patients are able to use. A little note about transportation. It's very challenging for us to think about how do we get our elderly patients home. What we ask is that when somebody comes into the emergency department, if you can just notify your family that you may be discharged and you may need a pickup. We might call people, your family members that are listed on your chart, and ask them to pick you up. And that can be done at any point of time. Our department works for 24 hours. We have to triage our space, and we talk about being ready for anything. And we discharge people at all times of day. Of course, we like to discharge people as quick as we can. But after hours, unfortunately, the taxi service locally has got challenges, and they don't run after certain hours. But we do discharge people at 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. and we will call family members to kindly pick up their loved ones and drive them home so they can sleep in their own bed rather than a hospital stretcher. And that means that we do that 24/7. And that is a common question that I sometimes get from family members. You know, will my loved one really get discharged at 3 a.m.? And the answer is yes. So that because we've done a thorough job and we're able to discharge them as quickly as we can, and we want to get them home. That is the end of my presentation. I kept it quite brief to allow some space for questions. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Paul. There are a bunch of questions in the chat, and then I've noted down a few questions too. So folks, you can write down the question in chat or just raise your hand and indicate and come on screen. I know this group is not shy. So Paul, you have really shared the back end of the emergency room, the how you process things, and it is not just the single point of contact between the emergency room doctor and the patient. There's a lot of work that the team does and you prepare. So a couple of questions, a very interesting question, and it is, I don't know who it is, it just says iPhone. What are the two things that you have seen other hospitals excel, because you've been at other hospitals, and that you think we need to implement and improve at NHHED?
Well, some of those things we've actually have been working on quite hard for the past 12 months. Changing how we do our imaging, looking at our medical directives. So for example, doing some lab tests and doing some investigations right off the bat from triage. We've expanded how we do our CAT scans, and we've worked with our radiology colleagues to figure out a process, how we do follow-up for mini strokes or TIAs, stroke protocols. And those are things that other hospitals do better because they have more resources. Sometimes other hospitals are also have contained specialists within their walls. So a fracture clinic could be available, you know, within a few hours rather than a couple of days. So I think one of the things we need to do is try to improve the collaboration between RAD and all the other referral services that we use, and how do we collaborate with them better? How do we get our notes to them better? How do we explain why the patient's referred better? And how do we communicate better between the patient and the referral center? And then the second part of that question, I'm just looking at the chat, is are the details of the visit always sent to the family doctor? And the way that Epic is designed, yes. If the family doctor is on file, they will get a copy of your note. It'll get faxed to them or to something called HRM, which is a backend routing system between physicians and the hospital. If the family doctor is not listed, or if we don't have their correct information, that is a case where sometimes the note might get lost in the electronic wires.
Thank you. The other question is, what happens in terms of checking or confirming medication if the pharmacy is closed? I know you talked about the above 65 group, but what about less? And because pharmacies are closed, you know, for significant number of hours.
And that is a challenge that we have. If the pharmacy is closed, we really have no way of verifying your medication. And that's why if patients present with a little handout from the pharmacy that lists their medication and their doses, that is very helpful to us. And sometimes we'll look at it, and sometimes we'll have the time to update the Epic chart. And sometimes we don't. Or sometimes we might put it in the note but not update the chart proper because of our time restraints or time constraints. But if you have the list with you, that gives us a general sense of what you're taking. And sometimes your medications are relevant to what brings you to the emergency department, and sometimes they're not. And sometimes the relevance of your medications is just interactions so that we know what we can and cannot prescribe for you. The reason we use the laboratory, the pharmacy technicians, is oftentimes for admissions. So if somebody's admitted, we need to verify their medication list with two separate sources, something called a BPMH, or best possible medical history. For an emergency room visit where the patient is not being admitted, we do not require to have a BPMH. We just need to have a list of medications to see how it applies to your visit.
So I would add to that, in terms of bringing the list, often what we find in office practice, but otherwise too, is when you bring the list, this is the list that the pharmacy ever sold, the list of things that the pharmacy sold to you. You may or may not be taking those medications. So it may even be more beneficial if you bring your pill bottles, because we can quickly read them and also at times get a sense of whether you're taking them regularly or not. It is safer to bring your pill bottles or your blister pack of what you're actually ingesting. So the next question is from Bill. Bill wants to know more about my chart. And in terms of, you talked about Epic, is there a way my chart is involved in the ER part, or what's the story with
my chart? Actually, Jennifer, I think, answered that question quite well. There is a link to my chart. When you open your chart, you're able to see your patient profile. So also a place where you can put in your own medications. And all of your notes and visits go there. Sometimes they're incomplete. So when we save a note prior to what we call signing a note, it actually is saved as a shared note. So sometimes if you're on your my chart during your visit in the ED, you actually will find incomplete notes. But once they're signed and completed, they get forwarded to our patients. And certain results will also get forwarded to patients. There's a delay on certain results to make sure that we've addressed any positives, like positive urine cultures or things that require antibiotics. We want to address those quickly and contact our patients, let them know that we're starting them with medications, fax a prescription to your pharmacy, and then put a separate note. The other question in chat is talking about the subjective feeling of sort of this never-ending wait. And that is challenging. And that is the purpose of this presentation, and to try to explain to our patients what goes in the background. And the only point that I can make here is, once you've made contact with a triage nurse, you've made contact with a team. And just because you haven't been brought to the back to speak to a practitioner, be it a nurse practitioner or a physician, we know why you're here. We may order tests before you see us, and we try to get to everybody as quick as we can. Communicating to our waiting room in terms of wait times is something we've discussed, but it's not an easy solution, because what I would not like to do is to say, well, you know, the wait is this many hours, and turn somebody away. Because again, people aren't cookie cutter, and people present with, let's say, heart attacks in different ways. And I don't want the wait time to be affecting the patient's perception of when they get seen. Because if somebody comes in and they're presenting with symptoms of heart attack, they'll get seen immediately. If somebody comes in with chest pain, but they don't have a heart attack, they might wait 2 to 3 hours to see somebody, but they'll get the blood work and investigations done immediately, right? And sometimes when we try to highlight the length of time that there is to be moved to the back or to be seen, it's very hard to reflect that because it varies. And sometimes it comes in clumps. Sometimes I have a nurse, I have a practitioner, but I don't have a room. And once I have a room, I can move in 5 patients and they could get seen within 20 minutes, right, of them being brought to the back. So it's very challenging to actually highlight what the wait time is. I can only highlight what the average length of stay. So how long does a patient wait to be discharged from the ED? And we try to do our best to communicate that.
Thank you. Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick point on my chart is also important to put down information on not your next of kin, but also your family member for contact purposes. So to your point, Paul, if somebody comes in and you've got to call somebody at 3 in the morning, you know from my chart who to call, the proxy.
Yes, thank you for that. That's actually quite important. And the other part that is quite important is when somebody calls in to check on their loved one, but they're not listed as a family member or next of kin, the law around privacy does not allow us to release that information to somebody who's not on the chart. And I know that's frustrating. And again, I have been a patient in the emergency department and I've had family members in the emergency department, but it is the law that's designed to protect patients and privacy. And that's why I say that if your loved one has a cell phone, you can always speak with them directly via cell phone, or they can let us know that we're able to speak to certain family members that may not be listed on the chart.
So, Paul, these are some of the questions that I'll pose to you. Often patients, or when we go to the emergency room, we may hear a story from somebody who's been to the emergency room who would say, I went to the emergency room, they checked me out, they didn't find anything. Does that mean that the person doesn't have anything wrong? Or you look for certain reasons that you were worried about, because the perception is you had blood work, you had x-rays, so you had a very thorough checkup and you have nothing going on. What would you say to that comment?
Yeah, so that's actually a very good question. And then perhaps I'll link it back to my sample patient, chest pain. Our tests in the emergency department are designed to look for acute things, but we are not able to rule out underlying disease that's not presenting with acute things. So for example, when we think about heart issues, we think about a heart attack. A heart attack is when a clot separates and blocks the pipes in the heart. And there's no more blood flow past the clot and a portion of the heart dies off. And that's what the attack part comes in. So we're able to rule out a heart attack in the emergency department, but we cannot rule out underlying coronary artery disease. So if over decades you've had some plaque and some buildup in arteries that made the diameter of the arteries smaller, but it doesn't cause any immediate damage to the heart, but you come in with certain chest pain, when you get chest pain or shortness of breath when you walk around, we are not able to rule that out based on tests, but we're able to have an index of suspicion based on history. That's why we ask your history 3 times. Because somebody might come in and say, well, you know, I get chest pain when I walk up the stairs and I take a little break and I'm fine. And that's been happening for a year. And my tests will rule out a heart attack, but my suspicion that you might have some coronary artery disease would be higher. And that's why the follow-up and the referral part is part of the visit. If I'm concerned about somebody having a heart condition or somebody having underlying disease or somebody requiring to see a surgeon, I refer them from the ER, and our disposition always includes what are the next steps, even if it is contacting your family doctor, what is the referral and why, and the specialists are able to do fancier tests to try to understand the underlying disease. But yes, my tests in the emergency department can miss underlying chronic condition because as an ER, we're designed to look for acute presentations.
Thank you. Jennifer Darrell.
Yeah, I'm just picking up on your comment about contacting somebody and privacy aspects. I've always given my next of kin when I go to the hospital, but I have no family in this community. Do you recommend that I therefore give my power of attorney for personal care as the contact information person?
Yes, you can give either of those people as the person to contact. So I guess the main question would be, who would you like us to contact if you are unwell and can't speak for yourself, or who would you like us to contact if you need a ride back home? And you're able to put more than one person. So the way that our charts are now designed, when you open up somebody's chart, on the bottom you see next of kin or the next of notify, but there's a tab for other, and the other people that you would like us to contact or somebody who's able to speak to you are listed in that. So you can provide both of those at the time of registration when you speak to the registration clerk.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Okay. So there's a question in chat from Joanne Allen. Is there an opportunity for a patient advocate, could be a trained volunteer, to the communication conduit from medical / paramedical staff to the patient?
Yes, that is something that we've discussed and something that we have looked at and probably will revisit again. Even having volunteers in the emergency department prior to the pandemic was helpful. One of the ways we're trying to bolster our supports is, like I said, trying to find other supports, other allied health, like the PSWs now, in trying to use other ways how we can communicate to our patients. Yes, there was opportunity for that. There is not an easy way how to do this, but we're always looking about how do we communicate to our patients better. And I'm just going to link that to the previous question in the chart. You know, that talks about, again, the sensation that we feel like we may have been forgotten. And that's a challenge. I mean, one solution to that is if we have a shorter wait time, we can move you into the emergency department proper from the waiting room. And you know that you haven't been forgotten because we're moving you along, right? And the only way we address that is try to improve and optimize our flow. You can always check in with a triage nurse. You can always get a status update from the triage nurse, but you are never forgotten. The benefit of the new Epic system is the fact that I can see the entire waiting room, including what they're here with, what hasn't been done, their triage nurse, everything directly from my computer. So even as I'm seeing somebody else, I can always get a bird's eye view of the department. More importantly, not me as a physician, but the charge nurse and the triage nurse have that view as well. So they're always acutely aware who's waiting. And they're always acutely aware that perhaps, you know, somebody who can be seen at discharge within a couple of minutes because they're just coming in to get an x-ray, where, you know, they have a soft tissue injury to their ankle, they want to get them in and they want to get them seen. You know, our goal is to get you back home. And we do our best. You know, we always look for ways to improve. I think the only way that people will feel that they're not ignored or forgotten is progressing them through the AD, or finding other or creative ways of how do we communicate to our waiting room of what's going on in the emergency department.
Thank you. We'll take just a couple more questions. I know we are just over time. So with all the references to a heart attack, can you please explain the difference between a heart attack and a massive silent heart attack?
That's probably a complex question to answer in this setting. What I would say to that, again, if our suspicion is high that there's underlying condition or underlying chronic disease, coronary disease, or a heart attack that has happened a few weeks ago, our job is to have that in the suspicion and refer people appropriately. And sometimes that means following up with the family doctor, and sometimes that means following up with a cardiologist specialist.
Thank you. I think one of the things that get mislabeled as a massive silent heart attack is what we call sudden cardiac death, where people die without any symptoms, and that is often due to an irregular heartbeat, but it gets labeled as, oh, they had a massive heart attack and they died. So Paul, one question. We've talked about a lot of common reasons why people come to the emergency room and they should come to the emergency room, like chest pain or shortness of breath. What, as a physician who is so seasoned in the emergency room and the practice of emergency medicine, that you see that they should have come to the emergency room, but commonly ignore those symptoms? and don't come to the emergency room. And by the time they seek attention, it may be late.
Probably stroke symptoms. And those are hard because, again, people aren't textbooks. People experience stroke symptoms in different ways. But stroke is a time-sensitive presentation. We're able to do something about it or do more within a certain period of time. So I would say to that, if somebody experiences symptoms that make them think they have a stroke, so they can't talk, they slur their speech, they can't get their words out, they have weakness in one arm or leg, but also other presentations like they've suddenly lost consciousness or they see double, or if their symptoms progress or remain and don't resolve, come to the ER sooner. Because if somebody ignores that, goes to bed, comes into us 24 hours later because the symptoms haven't resolved, unfortunately, at that point, the treatment options are more limited.
Right. What about sudden hearing loss? 1 year, suddenly you don't hear out of your ear.
Same thing. Same thing. Time sensitive, and I would present to the ER.
Right. This is one of those that I see that people get referred, and this is something that for this group, if you suddenly lose hearing in 1 year, or as a matter of fact, any symptom that starts very, very acutely, very abruptly, one should consider seeing somebody urgently. Paul, last question, and before we get to reminders and some housekeeping, wearable technology, people are wearing Fitbits, people are wearing Apple watches or Garmin watches, and they often give you a signal that your heart rate is high or your something is this. Should you pay attention to them? Should you go to the emergency room for that?
It depends if your symptoms are
consistent. You don't have any symptoms. Your watch just tells you something is wrong with you.
Yeah, I think it depends on how often it's doing that, right? So if you keep getting continuous reports on your wearable device that you have an irregular heart rate or a fast heart rate, then come in. If you've had it once and not had it again for many months, that could be something that a family physician can follow up on. I think, you know, I always talk about gut. You know, if your gut's unhappy, you're like, something's going on. You know, this wearable thing keeps telling me something's wrong with my heart. I don't feel anything, but it keeps alerting me. Come in. We're there to assess. And no matter what our wait times are, we will see everybody and always, and we don't turn anybody away. And if we can't find anything, we'll be open with you. If you need a referral, we will do that for you. And if we find something, then we can manage that.
Okay. And Paul, last question. When should you defer coming by ambulance versus private car? When should you choose the ambulance ride to the emerge? Because you said coming by ambulance doesn't get you there faster, but I'm at home. What kind of condition would you say, don't try to drive yourself to the emerge, call an ambulance?
If you feel unsafe to drive and you are unable to get to the emergency department, then calling 911 is appropriate and taking the ambulance is appropriate. It's a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
I don't want to discourage people from calling 911. All I'm trying to highlight is that no matter how you present to us, we will assess you equally. And sometimes that means that somebody presents in an ambulance, gets put in a chair because they're safe to be in a chair because they've been assessed and triaged and they will get seen just like everybody else. And sometimes somebody walks in through the door and they're unstable. And they get moved up to the front of the queue and get put in a critical care bed, right? An ambulance is a service that's designed for people who are unstable or unable to get to the hospital. If you feel unsafe to drive, it's very appropriate. If you feel safe to drive, and it's something that is not, you know, massive chest pain, passing out, you know, things that would make you feel that you could be unsafe to drive suddenly, and then you're able to ask for a ride or call your family member. But this is it's a broad question. Yeah. I'd say when appropriate, use the appropriate resource. Just know that we assess everybody equally.
Right. Thank you. So this is, thank you, Paul. Thank you for doing this. Emergency department at NHH is the department that never sleeps. just like they said, New York is the city that never sleeps. Emergency department and folks like Paul and others work shift work. The nurses work shift work, and they do a tremendous job. And you may think that the wait time is long, but in the long scheme of things, it is still short. People like have also questioned, why should there be a wait time in the emergency room? Everybody should be seen. But not everything in the emergency room is an emergency. That is why, as Paul said, you have triage, there's flow. And this is a significant team that is always connected to each other. They pull each other to where the need is. And often you will have three doctors, two doctors attending to the same patient, somebody getting the airway and somebody getting lines in and others calling somebody. They are also backed up by a bunch of other doctors in town by phone who are accessible and reachable to them. And then the bigger system, our partner hospitals, the Toronto hospitals, the trauma centers. So the acute care, emergency medicine, what you see is just the gateway. And Paul is leading that at NHH and his team. So thank you, Paul, for taking the time to do this. Thank you, folks, for attending. And of course, as Jennifer has put in this, the recording of such of this talk would be helpful. Please share it. Please do what you like with it. And in terms of future PACE sessions, we take a break for the summer for topics. We did have one outstanding topic from last year on joint health. We have a speaker. We have it all that it could be done in the next month, but typically we don't do June. July, August, and give everybody a break and a holiday. So we'll probably stick with it. But sign up for the newsletters from any of these organizations that are our sponsors, and you will get an invite. And Jennifer Darrell said that maybe there was some glitch with the invite. We'll certainly look at it. Once again, thank you and have a great night.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.